Okay. Welcome, everyone. My name is Jessica Collins. I am the Executive Director of the Public Health Institute of Western Mass, and we are thrilled to have you all with us today to learn about this very important topic about the COVID-19 vaccine. I'm honored to introduce our esteemed panel. We have State Senator Eric Lesser of First Hampden and Hampshire District. We have Dr. Sarah Hessler, the hospital epidemiologist at Bay State Medical Center, Vice Chair for Clinical Affairs at the Department of Medicine, University of Massachusetts Medical School at Bay State. We also have Dr. Amanda Westlake, who is an infectious disease specialist at Bay State Mason Square Neighborhood Health Center. And she's also the Assistant Professor of Medicine at University of Massachusetts Medical School. And she will be answering questions on the live stream as we have our program. And lastly, Associate Commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, Lindsay Tucker, will also be joining us. So thank you everyone for being here. And first I wanna start with you, Senator Lesser. Thank you so much for being with us today. I know you have a lot to share.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay? And everybody can see me okay? All right, good. Requisite Zoom check. But first, I want to thank you, Jessica. You're a great friend and partner and colleague on so many issues, food insecurity, certainly, of course, public health and all of the attendant items that are related to public health. So I want to thank you, and I want to thank the Public Health Institute of Western Mass. We just had a great live stream with Dr. Kathleen Zegda, which was really informative, and we shared your dashboard for Hampden County and for Western Mass, so people can definitely check that out. And I want to thank Dr. Hessler and Dr. Westlake, and I want to thank Lindsay Tucker from the Mass Department of Public Health for really heroic efforts over the last year. Look, this has been a hard year for everyone, but I do think there's, of course, light at the end of the tunnel here as we see that the vaccines do work. The data that came out of Israel, I think, is encouraging. It's gotten a lot of press coverage. The key challenge, I think, for us right now is going to be making sure that the vaccine is distributed in an equitable and speedy way, and certainly that our communities in Western Mass are not left out of that. So we've been working very aggressively as a delegation to really keep vaccine equity front and center in the state's decision making and policy making. We have in particular concerns about equity in terms of distribution of the vaccine in Western Mass. So a group of legislators, including Joe Comerford, Mindy Dom, Adam Gomez, and multiple other members of the Hampden County delegation have been working together both to ensure that adequate doses are brought to Western Mass and are specifically earmarked, so to speak, for Western Mass and for our most at-risk communities, but also that we're being mindful about the distribution and the mechanisms for accessing the vaccine. So just in particular, something we've been very focused on is the online-only system does not work. We need a phone option. The governor actually just announced about 15 minutes ago that a new 211 line is going to be open after several weeks of us pushing for that. And it's going to be right now in English and in Spanish with live callers. And then there'll be as many as 100, I believe, languages able to be translated from that. The other thing we need to do is we need to dramatically simplify the website. Right now, the mass.gov COVID website is just too confusing. There's too many links. There's too many places people have to go to navigate where and how to get their appointment, especially for the target demographic here, 75 or older, not always great with computers. And it's also worth pointing out that we have significant digital divides, both in our urban areas, but also many rural communities that don't have broadband access at all. So they've got to do more to streamline that system, and we've been pushing that. And then something Dr. Zegda and I talked about on our live stream, which is very much a priority of our delegation, is changing the mindset around the vaccine right now. The centralized mass vaccine sites are great. They're important for just speed and getting as many doses out as possible. But right now, the state is very much approaching this with the mindset of bringing people to the vaccine, whereas we need to be very mindful and deliberate about bringing the vaccine to the people. And that means things like mobile vaccination sites. It means localizing the vaccine distribution, getting it into our community health centers, working with trusted local partners in a culturally competent way to get the vaccine out. So there are a lot of things we don't control about the COVID-19 vaccine. Obviously, we are at the mercy of the federal government in terms of the number of doses we get. But we can be very mindful and we can be frankly aggressive about the advocacy that we undertake once the vaccines arrive in Massachusetts, how they're distributed, how we get them into people's arms. So you're the best in the business at doing this, the Public Health Institute of Western Mass. So just really want to say thank you to all of you. And I'll pitch it back over to you, Jessica, so that you can stop hearing from the elected officials and start hearing from the experts. But I do just want to lift up and thank everybody on this call who's worked so hard. And a real shout out to the medical teams at Bay State, at Mercy, at our community health centers that have just been on the front line of this for a year now. It's really been over a year since the first case was recorded in Massachusetts. So just again, can't thank you enough. And you're going to be important leaders for us in this new phase of vaccination and recovery.
Senator Lesser, thank you so much. I so appreciate you giving that broad background and all the themes that are really going to affect Western Mass's ability to do this well and do it equitably. And I'm very grateful for your leadership and for your advocacy. So thank you so much for spending this time with us today. Next, I would like to welcome Dr. Sarah Hessler, who will be doing a presentation and also answering questions. And before I let her speak, I also want to just say thank you to the other elected officials that have joined us today. If you are on live stream, we appreciate you being with us. So Dr. Hessler.
Great, thanks. So speaking of technology, I'm going to try to share my screen now. So hopefully, so somebody has to allow me to share my screen. It's disabled. So whoever the host is, if you could allow me, that would be great. Thanks. All right, let's see if this works now.
And yeah, Dr. Hessler, I just want to say also thank you so much for your leadership throughout this entire pandemic.
All right.
That you have shared your expertise.
Thank you. So somebody else is still sharing their screen. So let's see if I can get to mine. Okay, let's see my desktop. Share. Let's see if this works. Okay, hopefully this will go. If not, we'll take somebody else on and let's see. Here we go. Share. Okay, can you all see this now? Great. Okay. Well, you know, technology is challenging, but also miraculous. And so I just want to spend a few minutes just giving people an update on vaccinations. So this is who I am. Here's an overview of what we're going to talk about today. So I'll share with you, how do these vaccinations work? How are they developed so quickly? Usually they take years, right? Are they safe? What are the side effects? And are there medical contraindications or conditions that would prevent someone from getting vaccinated? Can pregnant people get vaccinated? And can we stop wearing masks once we're vaccinated? So those will be the main themes of my talk today. And again, I'm happy to entertain any questions at the end if we have time. And I know Dr. Westlake will be entertaining questions from you in the chat room if you have things that come up while I'm talking. Okay, so the work to create the vaccinations for COVID-19 were really built on prior prior work on SARS-CoV and MERS-CoV. So SARS-CoV was the virus that caused SARS, and MERS-CoV is Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. And these are both coronaviruses, and they have very similar functions. And so that prior work to try to develop vaccinations for those two diseases were what enabled us to quickly identify the target. So the spike protein on the surface of the virus is what allows us to, allows the virus here to bind onto our cells. And then in here, once it binds on, it enters into the cell and it releases its little virus in there. And then the virus takes hold of our cell machinery to make more of itself and then replicates within us. And so that spike protein is a great target for a vaccination, because if we can target the outside of that virus, it will and prevent the virus from accessing our cells, we can prevent ourselves from getting infected with it. So let's see. All right. So the mRNA vaccinations actually have been under investigation for decades. And this is a really fantastic story of a Hungarian immigrant named Katalin Karikó. This is a scientist who was working at University of Pennsylvania who was trying to develop mRNA vaccinations for decades. So mRNA is a very temporary signal that the body, the cells use. So the nucleus translates a piece of DNA, which is instructions to make a protein. And it makes it into a thing called messenger RNA. The messenger RNA comes out of the nucleus and goes into the cytoplasm of the cell. Ribosomes catch on to that mRNA, and they translate it into a protein. And that's how this works to grow all kinds of things for your body, to make hair cells and more intestinal cells and other things like that. So the idea around an mRNA vaccination was very attractive, because this is a very temporary molecule. It doesn't enter the nucleus. And wouldn't that be great to just be able to have the instructions for the one thing that you want? The problem is that mRNA is destroyed really quickly after it's used. Otherwise, it would build up inside your cells. So it's used and then destroyed. So how could you possibly get a mRNA into the body? That was the challenge. And so this person worked tirelessly since 1990, and she was actually demoted at Penn because she didn't come up with any results. But finally, in 2005, she figured it out about how to insert mRNA into cells. And that was around putting these lipid nanoparticles around the mRNA, which stabilized it and allowed it to be stable long enough to get engulfed by the cells. And then it releases inside the cells. And then the RNA mRNA is translated like any other mRNA into the spike protein. So this scientist now works for BioNTech, which is the German company that partnered with Pfizer to create the first vaccination, the mRNA vaccination, to receive emergency use authorization in the United States. So it's a very heartwarming story, and I'm grateful to all of the work that she put in order to help us get a jump start on creating these vaccinations. So how did they get approved so quickly? Well, the trials were overseen by the NIH, which is National Institutes of Health, which allowed them to start faster and also to coordinate the trials so that the endpoints were all the same, so they could compare them kind of head to head. And then they used this concept of Operation Warp Speed, which was federal funding for this. So the most promising candidate vaccinations were received government funding to help them to do the clinical trials and to actually start manufacturing the vaccines before the trials were even over, so that if they were successful, we'd have them ready to go. So this is a timeline here that you can see, which demonstrates all the way back in 2002 and 3, when SARS-CoV was identified, that these efforts were used to develop the trials for coronavirus vaccinations. Then in December of 2019, when the first cases appeared in China, by January of 2020, they had published the genetic sequence of this virus, which was really miraculous. And then multiple pharmaceutical companies started creating prototypes for vaccinations using that genetic sequence. Multiple different companies started down different pathways. There are other technologies besides mRNA vaccinations in order to create these. And some other pharmaceutical companies like Johnson & Johnson, for example, which is probably next up, is using a different technology. It's not mRNA, it's an adenovirus vector. So there's multiple different ways of getting the vaccine to work. And so these pharmaceutical companies started down these pathways, and the most promising candidates received additional funding in order to be able to ramp up their production and get their clinical trials done. So you see that by November, their preliminary data was strong enough for them to go in front of the FDA in order to seek emergency use authorization. Oops. Here we go. All right. So how do we know if these vaccines are safe? Well, they did very large clinical trials on them to ensure that the vaccinations achieved the safety standards that we demand in the United States. The FDA reviewed all of this safety data, and then they authorized through an emergency use authorization when the benefits of the product outweigh the risks. Then additionally, there's a separate process, it's separate but related, by the ACIP, which is the Advisory Council on Immunization Practices. And this is an independent body that is commissioned by the CDC to advise them on the safety of and schedules of various vaccinations. This is a body that's been in place for decades. Anybody that administers vaccines or looks up stuff about vaccine will see these schedules around when are you supposed to get a vaccine, at 18 months and at, you know, 3 years or at, right? And so the ACIP is the one that makes all of those recommendations. And this is made up of data scientists, infectious disease specialists, vaccinologists, and people that are experts in vaccine development. And so they pick through all of the data. They look for any signals that make them concerned that this wouldn't be safe for use or that it wouldn't be effective or not worth the risk. And so they also independently reviewed the data, and they would then make a recommendation to the CDC about giving approval or not for vaccinating or using that, approving that vaccination. And they did, by the way. So the FDA reviewed all of the data, and I've reviewed the data. It's pages and pages and pages of data around every single thing that they did in these clinical trials to ensure that they understood the safety and the efficacy of the vaccinations. And so then there are multiple systems in place in the United States to monitor for vaccine side effects and for any signal that there may be harm happening, or when you roll out a vaccination to a much larger population than the clinical trial size, that's when you would start to see very rare side effects. And so these monitoring systems are looking for a signal: is there any increase in something else, right? So everybody remembers the swine flu vaccine from the mid 1970s, where they saw Guillain-Barré follow, but only much later in much larger populations. And so that's what vaccine monitoring systems are for, is to look for signals in the data. And as of today, there have been no signals that indicate that this vaccination has caused any major safety signals or anything of concern, apart from a lot of the side effects that we're going to talk about and a few cases of anaphylaxis. And again, the anaphylaxis is something that occurs sporadically sporadically to people for, you know, usually unknown reasons. It's an allergy. It's very rare. And that is why there is the requirement to monitor people after they receive the dose. So people who are receiving a dose of the vaccination are required to be monitored for 15 minutes after their vaccination, or 30 minutes if they've ever had a bad reaction to a vaccine in the past. So there's lots of safety guardrails up around these vaccinations, which I think should reassure all of us. So here's some data around the phase 3 trials. So that's the large scale clinical trials. So the two that are currently in use by emergency use authorization are the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna vaccines. And you can see that they included adults. They included adults with both stable conditions and multiple chronic conditions. They excluded people who had COVID-19 in the Pfizer BioNTech trial. They had 20,000 get the vaccine and 20,000 get placebo in the Pfizer BioNTech. The Moderna had 15,000 people get a vaccine and 15,000 get a placebo. And then they were fairly evenly distributed from between male and female participants. You can see the racial makeup of the people that received vaccinations, as well as the age and some other background demographic factors, just so that you can understand that there was a wide range of people. These weren't all 20-year-old healthy college student volunteers that some trials have, and that would make them not widely applicable to the general population. And I think that what the take-home message from this slide is that there was a wide representation of people in these trials from age, racial makeup, as well as having underlying medical conditions. So this is my favorite graph really ever. This is called a Kaplan-Meier curve. And in medicine, we never see curves this good. This is incredible. It's really phenomenal. So the red line, this is from the Pfizer trial. So the red line represents the people that got the Pfizer BioNTech vaccination, and the blue line represents the people that got the placebo. And what the dots represent are the people that got COVID-19 over time after they got vaccinated, all right? So what you can see from this is that the curves coincide with each other. They just track really nicely. Everybody's still getting COVID for about the first 2 weeks. But you see that by day 14, and they magnified this nicely for you. That's what the magnified box is. They magnified to show you where the curves start to diverge, all right? So really about 10 days after the first dose is when in the trials, they started to see that people that got the vaccination really stopped getting COVID. And the people that got the placebo just kept getting it and getting it and getting it. And it's amazing. We never see this kind of difference between a placebo and a treatment in medicine. The curves are always just slightly different, and everybody starts to argue, really, is that clinically effective? Is that really impactful? Should we really be using this drug? But this is really remarkable. And the Moderna Kaplan-Meier curves were essentially a mirror image, or a exact replica of this. The results were basically exactly the same. So what can you expect after getting vaccinated? Well, there were a lot of side effects noted in the trial. The side effects are predominantly sore arm. Almost everybody who gets the vaccination will have a sore arm. It's generally relatively short-lived. The vaccine itself really does not hurt. I can tell you that by personal experience, because I've been vaccinated and I've been a vaccinator at our vaccine site, and everybody that I've vaccinated said, "Are you sure you're done? That I didn't even feel that." And so it's for those who are needle phobic or scared of the pain of the vaccine, the vaccine itself really doesn't hurt going in. The soreness comes 8, 10, 12 hours later. people start to feel the sort, they realize, ooh, there it is. And, you know, lots of people experience this after getting a flu shot, after getting a tetanus booster, et cetera. A smaller number of people, so about 80% of people have a sore arm. So about a much smaller number, somewhere between 20 and 40% of people have been getting a more robust response. And this is a what we call reactogenicity. So them just reacting to this vaccine. It's the immune system activating, saying, wow, there's something different in me. That's not me. I better react to that. And so it responds. And what it does is what it knows how to do, which is cause a little fever, some chills, tiredness, little headache, achiness, body aches, joint pains. And these things last usually a day or less. And again, less than half of the people that get vaccinated have been getting these side effects. I think it's really helpful to know what to expect and to know that they might happen to you. You can take some analgesics if you are experiencing a lot of these symptoms to make you more comfortable. So acetaminophen, ibuprofen are good choices to help with those symptoms. The symptoms do go away usually after a day or two. There's very rare cases of people having a little longer effect. The side effects tend to be more pronounced after the second dose than the first dose. But again, these are mostly what you expect with lots of other vaccinations. So why are vaccines the best choice? Why don't you just wait it out and see, or why don't we all just, this theory of, can we get herd immunity by just everybody getting COVID? So those are not good strategies. And I'll tell you why, because people who get COVID have a really high risk of morbidity and mortality from COVID. It's not a good disease to get. It's not, as you may have heard in some circles, just the flu. It's not just the flu, especially in our vulnerable populations. It can cause a lot of morbidity and certainly mortality. And in this region, we have had, unfortunately, many lost lives due to COVID-19. And so the vaccination, on the other hand, has the opportunity to create immunity through vaccine and prevent us from getting infected and prevent us from having the morbidity and mortality. It's certainly a lot safer to get vaccinated with knowing that there are just minor side effects associated with it than it is to take your chances and get infected with COVID-19. The other obvious and most important factor here is that the more people that get vaccinated, the closer we get to herd immunity and the closer we get to going back to a life where we can see our family and friends return to, pre-pandemic activities. So what about pregnant people? Should they get vaccinated? So there's been a lot of concern because pregnant people were excluded from the clinical trials. However, there were many people that became pregnant during the clinical trial, and they are being followed very actively. And in addition, since the vaccination has been approved through emergency use authorization, many, many, many pregnant people have been vaccinated. So this is a decision that is a personal one. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, ACOG, recommends that that pregnant people should be considered for vaccination, that they should not be excluded from opportunities to be vaccinated and should not have to undergo testing or proof or anything. They should just be offered the vaccination and they can make their own decision. And so there are decision tools out there. Here's an example of an excellent decision tool that our own Dr. Elizabeth Schoenfeld and multiple colleagues at Bay State worked on to help people really think through and talk through with their family, friends, and provider, what is the risk and what is the benefit of receiving the vaccination if the person is pregnant or wishes to become pregnant in the future. So the next question that we receive a lot is, are there contraindications or people with medical conditions that should prevent them from getting the vaccination? I did not include this slide because I wanted people to try to read tiny fine print. I included it because this comes from the CDC, where they created a nice, really helpful decision tool for people to decide whether or not they should avoid getting the vaccine. And we'll start here in the bottom right-hand corner without the red allergies, okay? Really, the only people on this chart that says contraindications to vaccines are people who have had a severe allergic reaction to any component of the COVID-19 vaccine, right? And so that's basically almost nobody. Those are the only people that have a real contraindication. And even then, it's not a true real contraindication. What it means is that those people should be seen by an allergist have a, again, a risk-benefit discussion about having a second dose. So then everybody else is either in this yellow column or a green column. So there are conditions and allergies in the two boxes. And what you can see is that people who have currently sick with a moderate to severe acute illness should get a risk assessment and probably defer the vaccination just because they're sick. And why introduce something that might cause side effects? Probably defer the vaccination. Then in the allergies, people with an immediate allergic reaction to any kind of other vaccination should undergo a risk assessment. And these are the people that are getting observed for 30 minutes rather than 15 minutes. You move over to the green box, and it's basically everybody else. Everybody else should be offered a vaccination and be monitored for 15 minutes. And I think that this is just really helpful to think through. Almost nobody shouldn't get offered a vaccination. Okay, so once I'm vaccinated and fully vaccinated, do I still have to wear a mask? Can I take it off now? And can I start, seeing people closer than 6 feet? The answer is no, you cannot, or yes, you still have to wear your mask and physically distance after getting vaccinated. So these are safety precautions. As the vaccination rolls out, the majority of the population still is not protected, and there is still very high rates of virus circulating in our community. And this is going to be so until we get to the point where we have enough people that are immune that the rates drop down. At Bay State Health, we're still seeing, 50 to 100 new positive tests per every day. And we do about a third of the testing in the region. So triple that number and you'll get how many new people are still being diagnosed in our region with COVID on a daily basis. This is not gone. It's still happening. And so we need to continue to practice these safety precautions until we have a much higher level of immunity in the population. Also, the vaccination, as you saw on that Kaplan-Meier curve, it takes a while to develop immunity. So after 10 to 14 days is when we start to see a divergence in the curves. But the full protection really doesn't occur until about 2 weeks after the second dose is when the immune response is finished doing its job and you've got the maximum that you're going to get. So the bottom line is, even though you're vaccinated, you still need to wear your mask, stay 6 feet apart, avoid crowds, and wash your hands very frequently. And alcohol hand rub, yes, is as good, if not better, than washing with soap and water. So this is a nice schematic that just shows what I was talking about in terms of a concept, right? So this is Swiss cheese, right? So there's lots of little holes in Swiss cheese, but occasionally a hole in the Swiss cheese can line up and go all the way through, right? So this is why you need to have multiple layers of protection in order to prevent COVID-19. So important layers of this include the physical distancing, the hand hygiene, mask wearing, avoiding crowds. And you see that vaccinations are the last layer of protection within this Swiss cheese model. I also want to point out that tiny little mouse that's in there. Okay, what is the mouse doing? The mouse is chewing new holes. The mouse represents misinformation. Okay, and I know that we all deal with this on a daily basis, but misinformation can really undermine a lot of the work that we all do in medicine and public health to try to ensure that people have the best information, that they understand what the benefits are of all of these basic public health practices to protect themselves and their loved ones and their community. So this is the last slide, just some information on where more details can be found. The CDC has excellent information, the mass.gov, always up to date, fantastic information. Bay State has a lot of information around our vaccinations and how you can get a vaccine. At Bay State, Mercy as well has information about how to find a vaccination. And also, of course, your own personal healthcare provider can help you to navigate that as well. So with that, I'll stop and cede the floor.
Great. Dr. Hesler, thank you so much. That was fantastic. And I appreciate that you went into the details of the earlier days of the development of the vaccine. I think that's incredibly important for people to understand. This was in the works for decades and that, you know, science has been truly working on this very hard for a long time. So a couple of questions. You answered many of the questions, but here's a couple. Are you able to speak at all to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that we're hearing a lot about in the media?
It has not received emergency use authorization. It's coming. They have not released the data for me to actually speak to it with any authority yet. So I'm going to defer on that one just because I don't have enough information.
That's fine. So just for folks out there, we will put all these slides up on our website. And as new information like this comes out and we get more information from folks like Dr. Hesler, we will share that through our website. Okay, another one is how long after getting another vaccine, for example, flu or shingles, should someone wait before going for COVID?
Great question. Super glad that that one was asked because there is a specific time frame and it is 2 weeks, 14 days. So if you have gotten a flu shot or Shingrix or MMR or Tdap or any of the other vaccinations out there, the recommendation is to wait 2 weeks before getting a COVID vaccine. Conversely, if you've gotten a COVID vaccine, you want to wait 2 weeks before you get one of those other vaccines. Now, think about the fact that the COVID vaccines require two doses. So the timing, really, you need to think about it if you're going to get let's say you want to get Shingrix, which, by the way, hurts a lot more and has a lot more side effects than the than the COVID vaccine. So if you wanted to get Shingrix, and you'd already gotten your first dose of COVID, you would want to wait on the Shingrix. Okay, so wait, then you get your second dose of the COVID vaccine, because that's going to be either 3 or 4 weeks apart. And then 2 weeks later, you can start your Shingrix series.
Okay, great. And another question, can you speak to children and why we're not vaccinating children at this time?
Sure. Great question also. So these vaccinations were tested in the case of the Moderna, adults 18 and above were included in the trials. And the case of the Pfizer BioNTech, 16-year-old and above were included in the trials. So the emergency use authorization is approved for people in those age categories. So we don't actually have any clinical data. And so they were not approved for use. So they're not being rolled out to children yet because they're not even approved. I am aware of clinical trials that are involving children. It's much harder to do a clinical trial involving a child. There's a lot of consent issues, parental, involvement that needs to occur in order to, and ethical issues, obviously, and including children in trials. And so they were not included in the original one. So they've not been included in the first phases because they're not approved for that age group.
Okay, so as more information comes out, we will share that as well.
Right, and we can expect that these things will probably change over time as the trials are done. And then again, the FDA would then review all the data and make a decision about whether they would be approved in a lower age range.
Okay, great. Thank you. Another question regarding new strains and variants. Yeah. Can you speak to that?
Yes, we spend a lot of time looking at the data on new variants, right? Okay, so there are multiple different variants of the virus that are circulating. And that is because viruses are very sloppy in their replication. Okay, so as our own cells have a number of proofreading functions to them, so that when an mRNA comes out of the nucleus and starts getting translated by our ribosomes, there is some proofreading that goes on to make sure that they got it right. And if they didn't get it right, they junk that one, okay? But viruses don't have that proofreading stuff. And so when they get translated, sometimes mutations occur because the wrong thing was translated. And so it's a little bit wonky and off, right? And if those mutations confer a survival advantage to the virus, meaning it makes it more easily transmitted, you know, more for the virus to be passed on more easily, then that virus is going to survive more, right? It's going to be passed on more. And so these things arise by chance, but if they confer a survival advantage, they create a system of spreading themselves that is essentially more, right? And so the main variant that is of concern right now is the UK B117 variant. Okay, so this is the reason why it was even discovered in the first place is that the United Kingdom leads the globe in monitoring and doing surveillance of the strains that are circulating in their country. All right, so they the National Health System takes a huge percentage of the strains that when they diagnose a patient, they do genome sequencing on it and are looking for mutations. No other country in the world is looking as hard as the UK is, okay? And so they started to see a couple months ago this variant emerge, and then they started to see that it was getting more and more and more in their population. And through mathematical modeling is how they figured out that it was something that probably confers greater infectivity because, again, mathematically, from the time it appeared in their data until the time it became one of the most dominant strains was X amount of time. So therefore, right, in terms of transmissibility, it was more transmissible than variants before it. Does that make sense? All right. And so that's where the concern about this comes from. That if it's more transmissible and we have a population that isn't immune yet, then, you know, we could have even more cases. It could drive even more of the pandemic until we can get people to be vaccinated and have immunity. The other concern around the variants is will one of those survival advantages confer resistance to the immunity that the vaccine confers, right? Okay, so everybody's worried about that. The initial data that we have from the BioNTech trial, they took some sera from those people and they challenged it with the B117, the UK strain. They found that the antibodies in that sera neutralized that strain just fine. So we're not worried about that one, but there is another strain from South Africa variant from South Africa that does appear to confer some increased immunity to our vaccinations. So not exactly confer immunity. I don't mean to say it that way. So decrease the amount or evade our immune system, I guess is the best way for me to say that. And so we are in the United States increasing the amount that we are monitoring for these variant strains. There's a really great new website that the CDC created that demonstrates how many cases we have in the United States of each of these variants. And they update it a couple times a week. I don't know if anybody has looked at that one, but it's really nice to see, and it breaks it down by state and demonstrates how many cases that they've detected in each of the states. So the state departments of public health have asked the various reference labs in the region, so Bay State reference lab being one of them, to send strains to them, and they test a random assortment of strains all every week. They're testing them through the genome sequencing to detect, are we seeing cases of these variants in Massachusetts, just so that we can keep in front of this and understand, do we have anything to be worried about?
Oh, okay. So more information to come on that.
Absolutely.
As that comes out, we will surely post it and be looking for you for information. Dr. Hessler, I want to say thank you so much for your time. This has been incredibly helpful and sort of a perfect lead in right now to Associate Commissioner Lindsay Tucker, who's joined us to talk about what is going on at the state and what their strategies are. So Lindsay, welcome so much. And I know you're going to share your slides and take it away.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Good afternoon, everyone. Jessica, really appreciate the invite and excited to be with you all this afternoon. Thank you so much for your time. So I'm Lindsay Tucker. I'm the Associate Commissioner at the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. And really, just appreciate this opportunity to talk to you about the vaccine deployment and rollout. And I hope that I am complementing what has already been stated. I apologize that I wasn't able to be on earlier. So I will go quickly and then hopefully we can have a few minutes for questions at the end. So next slide, please. I imagine that folks are familiar with this particular graphic, but just wanted to spend a minute on it. If you could go back, perfect. So the Commonwealth has a phased vaccine rollout, as do most states. Many states, however, have different phasing. And so if you are in touch with friends and family in other states, timeline and exactly who is in which order, the order of priority may be different. And just recognizing that is confusing and perhaps also frustrating. But we have really prioritized equity in thinking about the phased rollout here. And phase one is still ongoing while we have also started phase two. So right now, all people in phase one are eligible for a vaccine. This is all healthcare workers, both COVID-facing and non, and also long-term care facilities, first responders, congregate settings. That is the space that I personally am spending a lot of time these days working on deployment for shelters and congregate settings. This includes correctional facilities and then also home-based healthcare workers. And as you may know, this past Monday, phase two started with individuals 75 and over. There are a variety of places where all of those people can be vaccinated, and I will talk about that in a second. But you may be asking, when are we going to get to that next bullet point in phase two? And the answer is soon. So we are, as you may have heard from some of the press conferences that the governor and the secretary have been saying, we unfortunately do not have as much supply of vaccine as we would like in order to move as quickly as we would like. And so until we are able to get more supply into the state, we are not yet going to be moving to open up and activate that second bullet point. But that is something that we are very much looking toward and interested in. And one thing that I will flag that is not clear from this language, because this is so high level, is that pregnancy is actually on the list as a condition that if you have an additional comorbidity, would put you in that category of having 2+ comorbidities. So just if you work with pregnant women or if you are in that space, there will be much more information coming to you, but just flagging that because pregnant women who have another health indicator that would make them in that comorbidity status, they are eligible in that second bullet point as well. Moving into other workers, some really essential and critical workers for keeping our lives up and running, including early education, daycare, K-12, grocery, food, transit, et cetera. Really looking toward making sure that we are getting enough education and information out for folks. So next slide, please. We have a lot of information. Oh, the next slide is the priority slide. So before I talk about the website, the Vaccine Advisory Group, which was pulled together in the fall to give us in the administration guidance around the prioritization process, are in their guidance really prioritizing these three things. One, preserving the healthcare system, and that's why healthcare workers were really first on that list, making sure that we are able to vaccinate our healthcare workers so that they can continue to support and serve us in all of the ways that they do. Limit severe morbidity and mortality, and then promoting equity. Really having that be one of the three tenets in that phased prioritization process. And as an example there, when we think about folks in the healthcare system, just the example here is not for example, just doctors and nurses, but anybody in that healthcare setting. So including janitorial staff, home health workers, et cetera. So thank you, next slide. We have a lot of information on our website. It's really terrific and also can be a little overwhelming just because of the volume. So wanted to talk about a couple of the different things that are up there so that you can peruse at your leisure and also hopefully find things that are useful to you in your conversations and in your organization. So next slide, please. There are a number of graphics that hopefully provide information to you, but that you can use. You can print them, you can email them, you can use them in Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, whatever your social media of platform of choice is, and use that as a way to get some of this information out. So those are on our website at the link that is above. Jessica, you and your team now have these slides, so feel free to send them around and people can just click. But next slide, please. A number of sites on the website also explaining where you can go to get vaccinated. So there is a map and it is searchable. You can put in your zip code and see what is close to you if you are currently eligible to get a vaccine. You can use this map to help you. And if you were just listening to the governor's press conference, then you likely know we also have a phone line available now to help folks if the web is not the best tool for them and they don't have another option for signing up online, there is now a phone line available to help folks. There are different colors on the map and it's explained on the website, but the mass vaccination sites that are open to everyone are in red. And so those have been announced. For example, Gillette was the first one, Fenway just opened. Then there are, it looks blue, but I'm pretty sure on the website it's green, but there are then public vaccination sites that are at locations that might feel slightly more comfortable to people, including pharmacies. So not as big as, for example, Gillette, but maybe a Walgreens or a local CVS or a local health system satellite that has clinics available. UMass Amherst had a bunch of clinics over the past couple of weeks, for example. And so those are really terrific geographically. And then the yellow are restricted, not open to the whole Commonwealth, but restricted either based on geography. So example, some local boards of health who want to vaccinate their community, but don't feel like they have capacity to vaccinate everybody in the Commonwealth. And so limiting it, or some other health system type sites that again are limited, but that information is there on the website. And so hopefully you can find some information about that. And additional sites as well as appointment slots get added regularly. So if you don't find something that you are looking for today, try back next week. And I believe, but please don't quote me on it, that the mass vaccination sites release new appointments every Thursday. So that may also be just something to check in on if you are looking. Next slide, please. Back to some more information that is up on our website. And I imagine that this was already discussed on this webinar in terms of the content, but we do have posters, graphics, FAQs, and they are translated into 10 different languages. So we do have multilingual translation up on the website for these flyers and posters. And so please feel free to print or to email out for folks that English is not a first language. Definitely wanting this to be as accessible as possible. We also are looking to release very shortly our public communications campaign. And so that will have more information on the radio and other ways to reach people, not just visually. We'll have more audio. So for folks, again, just reaching people in different ways and in different spaces. Next slide, please. And I recognize we are coming to time, but if you are interested in hosting a forum for your community or your organization or stakeholders, there is a PowerPoint that is up on our website, and you are welcome to use these slides. Hopefully they can be helpful for you. You can adapt them for what makes sense for your organization. We also just released yesterday an announcement that next week and the week after, we are hosting webinars that will kind of be train the trainers. So we will walk through how to use this PowerPoint and ways in which you might be able to adapt it to work for you. Jessica, if you and your team did not get that, I will email that to you and then you can send that out for folks. But again, an hour next week and an hour the week following to talk about hopefully how to use some of these materials in a way that might be helpful for you. Next slide, I think, is the last one. These are live links. And so again, hopefully Jessica's team can send this around because then you can just click on them. But for more of this information, these are the places on our website to get you some of this detail and hopefully some of these resources that can help you. I will pause, I will end there. And then Jessica, any questions in our last few minutes, happy to take and happy to follow up afterwards as well.
Okay, great. Lindsay, thank you so much. That was terrific. And I know a ton of information. I appreciate the equity angle and both from a race and ethnicity perspective, but also obviously from a regional, rural, suburban, urban perspective as well. A couple of specific questions people are asking. What about folks that are receiving chemotherapy? Is that considered a comorbidity? When you said pregnancy was considered, someone asked, is chemotherapy?
Pregnancy was just top of mind because of my last meeting. So I don't have the full list in front of me, but I do believe a current cancer diagnosis is on the list.
Okay.
And so I would like to follow up before I am quoted in any way on that,
that's
but
fine.
Can send you the full list that we have from the CDC of folks at greatest risk. And if anybody knows that off the top of your head, please jump in. But I do believe current cancer is on it.
Okay. And then another question specific in this phase two for homebound residents, is there specific information they can get to support their access?
That's a really great question. So it meaning if you are over 75 and homebound, what is an, okay, great. So we are working on some options so that the vaccine can come to you. And there will be more information when we have that, but recognizing that there are a number of people that for a variety of reasons cannot easily leave the house and that there will need to be mobile vaccination and have the vaccine come to you.
Okay.
So more information to come there, but absolutely something that we are recognizing as a need and one that we will need to be filling.
Okay. And then another very specific question someone's asking, can you get a shot in Massachusetts and in Connecticut or New Hampshire? What's the feedback on that?
Yeah, so it is strongly recommended that you get your first and your second dose from the same location, but you don't have to. So it is easier for us to track if you get it in the same location and if you get it in the same state. But there is a national system, and when you get your first vaccine, you will get a card letting, you know, so that you know which vaccine you got and when you need the second one, and you can then use that. So if you happened to get an appointment in New York and now are eligible in Massachusetts for your second vaccine, you can certainly use that card. And just, again, you need to be sure that you are getting the same version of the vaccine. So if you got Moderna first, you need to get Moderna second. If you got Pfizer first, you need to get Pfizer second.
That's very helpful. And then the last just couple of minutes, Dr. Hessler, I invite you and Associate Commissioner Tucker to answer this, but for people who are feeling anxious and they're afraid in the last few moments, what is your advice? What are your recommendations? What do you suggest to ease their fears and feelings about the COVID-19 vaccine?
Doctor, I defer to you.
So I would recommend first and foremost to educate yourself around the safety of the vaccination and to talk to trusted sources around it. So your own personal healthcare provider, as well as people that you know who have been vaccinated. So there, you know, many healthcare workers in our community now are vaccinated because we all went first. So there was, I think, a little trepidation there among healthcare workers because although it was really exciting to be given access to the vaccine, you're going first, right? And so you don't know whether or not there's gonna be anything bad that happens. And so I think that a lot of our healthcare workers were anxious at first, but then as they saw their colleagues getting the vaccine and doing fine with it, and then being really excited that now there's sort of light at the end of the tunnel, there's some hope for us out there. Really helped to bolster confidence in it. And again, the more that you, you know, the more that you know about this, the more I think that people will feel comfortable with it. Knowledge is power. And so knowing what you're up for is, can I think help people feel more comfortable.
Great. Thanks, Lindsay. Do you want to add anything?
No, I think that was incredibly well said. Okay. And we recognize that it's a journey, and some folks might not feel comfortable today, but might feel comfortable tomorrow. And so we just really want to be sure that when you are eligible, the vaccine is available for you, and that you can access it when you are ready for it.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Thanks so much, Lindsay, for joining. I know you're very busy. And like you said, it's a journey and things are coming out, you know, every day. And we'll be sure to post information as we can. And Dr. Hessler, thank you so much again for your time and your leadership. And Dr. Westlake behind the scenes, who's been answering questions on the live stream. And Senator Lesser, if you're still with us, thank you so much. We will post the slides. We will post the link in the recording. We will continue to push out information and try to educate with other folks in our region. There's a couple of webinars coming up in the city of Springfield over the next 2 weeks, and we will have those dates and times on our website as well, being done by other groups. So thank you, everyone. We're beyond our time, and we appreciate you so much for joining us today. So take care of yourself and your loved ones, and thank you again.